The inquiry into Victoria's ill-fated hotel quarantine program is gathering pace, with senior ministers this week being grilled about their part in this. The Premier, Daniel Andrews, will give evidence tomorrow, but today is the turn of Health Minister Jenny Markakos. Two of her colleagues have already pointed the finger of blame at her department, with Police Minister Lisa Neville and Jobs Minister Martin Pakula yesterday saying it was ultimately in charge, that her department was ultimately in charge of the program that led to Victoria's second wave of COVID. But neither minister that's appeared so far could say who made the decision to use private security guards. Professor Kristen Rundle is a specialist in public law at Melbourne University Law School. She's been following this inquiry closely. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Hamish. Thanks for having me.
The intention of all of this is to learn lessons, to ensure that there is no repeat. How important is it to find out where the decision was made, who it was made by, and why it was made in order to learn whatever those lessons are?
That's an excellent question. I'm glad to hear you start with the point of lessons, Hamish, because I think what we're seeing now is that we're not necessarily going to come to a satisfactory conclusion from this inquiry with respect to this question everyone is asking about who made the decision. I think the uncomfortable answer to that question is that there really wasn't a who and there really wasn't a decision. And so if we're to take those materials that we are hearing from the inquiry, the question becomes, okay, what do we need to do with that? How do we need to think about what was at stake in the outcome that evidently followed that is not translating into a clear line of vision as one person making a particular decision in this instance?
Could you explain that a bit more? Because it strikes me that that speaks to some of the testimony that was given by Lisa Neville, the police minister, where she was sort of seemed to be describing that it was not a surprise to her, didn't seem unusual to her that private security might be used in a circumstance like that. She just couldn't seem to pinpoint a discussion or a decision process around it. What does that tell us about the way government services are being delivered?
It tells us a lot, and I think the emergency circumstances here are particularly revealing for what they tell us about starting assumptions, and that's the point you were just getting at there, Hamish. We have an entrenched culture of contracting out across all governments in Australia, and so what Minister Neville was gesturing to was that the use of private security contractors, often alongside some combination with the police, but in some combination there, but the reliance on them is common across a range of situations, and that she wasn't surprised because that seems to be a starting assumption. And I think that that's, to my eyes, what is so important about the focus on who made a decision is the inquiry's and the public's expectation that there was a decision, meaning there was a choice between alternatives to be made. And yet what seems to have been revealed is that there was then, and one might assume customarily is, very little reflection on what is at stake in the choice between those alternatives.
So just on that question of alternatives, because a lot of the media coverage, certainly in a lot of the political debate around it, has been around the role of the police and whether the police should have been doing it, the offer of ADF personnel to perform that function. Are you saying that in the moment of rolling out these measures, and of course we've all got to remember the sort of fraught circumstances, that those other options that we now see may not have been there or may not have been discussed? Is that what you're suggesting?
I don't think it's ever a matter of them not being there. I think, like in the New South Wales system, for example, there's aspects of the public health legislation that mandate the use of police officers in certain circumstances, whereas in the Victorian scenario, my understanding is it's less mandated than possible or available. It is one of the options. I don't get the sense from what I have followed in the evidence that the option wasn't there. There was simply an assumption of equivalence between the work of police in this situation and the work of private contractors. And that's a very, very puzzling assumption when you understand what quarantine is as something that evidently is an infection control measure, but it's also a regime of detention that needs to be enforced. So I don't think there was a matter of saying we don't have the available police officers. Certainly evidence later in the inquiry from one of the police commanders suggested that it might not have been an efficient use of police resources. But that's a different judgment to whether it was an appropriate instance for the use of police in these circumstances.
We all know that at every level of government now there is there has been for some time a huge shift towards contracting out of services, and you know, the big four consulting firms do a lot of the policy work. Are you saying that there is a sort of dilution of the responsibility mechanisms that would normally, that perhaps as a community we would assume exist within our Westminster style of government?
That's a really lovely way of formulating the point, Hamish, and yes, I do agree with that. What we have as a result of devices or techniques like contracting out is that there is a lot standing between people and those who are accountable to them in these models of government. These, like, for example, yesterday, Minister Pakula from the Department of Jobs, Precincts and Regions spoke about how it's not typical for ministers to be aware of the contracting practices. And he wasn't speaking then of just trivial contracting practices for like small money or small tasks. He was talking in general terms. And it's important there to see that this is a feature of this practice. Once you've committed to contracting out, there's actually a lot of mechanisms that have to come into play that stand between even departments and their ministers. And the worry there is the point you just made, Hamish, which is that it effectively renders the stories we tell about political accountability, that ministers of government are responsible to their electors, for example, that it renders them theoretical. And I think what has happened in this example and why we have so much to learn from it in its aftermath is that the public reaction to not just the COVID-19 second wave breakout that was facilitated through the failure of the hotel quarantine system, but the news that it was contracted out at all was met with bewilderment through to outrage. I think we are learning something extremely important for all Australian governments here about what citizens expect from their governments and how the choices made about who delivers government functions and how genuinely matter to the people who are affected by them.
So if we follow the points that you're making through to a sort of logical conclusion, are you saying that it is important when there is a big failure like this that at a political level, someone does take responsibility?
I think, of course, it's important that someone takes responsibility, but we have to ask, Hamish, what do we want of the direction moving forward as the kind of content of that responsibility? Because what we're seeing here is a multi-agency operation overlaid by emergency management and structures and so forth. We've got the complexities of modern government laid out before us. To some extent, it's going to be, as I said, hypothetical, or someone's going to nominate themselves to sort of put their hand up and say, okay, I'll be the one that says I'm responsible. But it's not necessarily meaningful, and we need to work out how to reform the structures to make it more meaningful. But in terms of taking responsibility, it's like anything in life. What does that mean? Are we going to do something differently moving forward? And that's why I said before, we may not come to a satisfactory conclusion on this straight line question of who made the decision and therefore who is accountable, but we could have a satisfactory reset in reconsidering some of these structures and their implications.
You published a policy briefing paper in recent days, which has been submitted to this inquiry, looking not only at the question of accountability, but also the legal flaws as you see them in appointing private security guards in a public health matter. Victoria was not the only jurisdiction in Australia that engaged private security in some of these roles. Is there something that, I know you've already mentioned that there is different legislation in New South Wales as an example, but was Victoria doing something entirely different and out of step with every other part of the country?
I don't think they necessarily were. I think what has occurred is a difference of degree, a difference in the configuration, the balance between the use of public personnel who have much clearer lines of command and communication and authority and so forth, and private contractors. The Victorian example had the private contractors at the very front line of the quarantine operation, that they're literally outside the door of the person detained. So every state that's been involved in these processes has some combination of that, but the Victorian model lent heavily on the private security front line. So even if, I really think we need to think about, even if nothing went wrong in terms of the fact that there wasn't a breakout of COVID that followed from this, there's still room, in fact, I'd say the necessity for some foundational rethinking about how these designs worked. It's just that in the Victorian case, there have been disastrous consequences that have necessitated laying bare these structures and calling upon us to reflect on how they might be done differently in the future.
I suppose the reason I'm asking that question is because if this is genuinely about learning lessons, should the rest of the country be looking at this as well, even though they haven't had the disastrous consequences that Victoria has too?
In my view, yes. Because what we have here is a story of how contemporary Australian government designs and performs. And that the use of contracting out, the complicated mega department structures, for example, but particularly of interest to me is the use of contracting out as a central technique of government, not something that is occasionally turned to, but that much of the structure of government is oriented to its performance. That is not unique to Victoria in any way. So while those of us in Victoria have a particular interest in this, and while we have particular political actors that are under the spotlight in the Victorian example, this is actually an Australian story. It's actually a global story about the nature of contemporary government laid bare.
Professor Kristen Rundle, thank you so much.
Thank you for your time. You're welcome.
Professor Kristen Rundle is a specialist in public law from Melbourne University Law School. And as I say, she's submitted that policy briefing paper to the inquiry looking at the question of accountability.